Salam dear listeners and welcome once again to Vahini Satsang. So today now we are in the 17th chapter of Prema Vahini, and as always along with me is Sai Prakash. So let's get started listening to what Bhagwan has written in this chapter, a fresh chapter, and Swami is now moving on from samskaras to a very important topic. Let's pay attention and then we will discuss more in detail.
మానవ కోటికి మాతృదేవి సనాతన ధర్మమే. లోకమున సర్వమతములకు, సర్వ సంప్రదాయములకు, సర్వధర్మములకు సనాతన ధర్మమే తల్లి. అట్టి తల్లి పుట్టినిల్లే ఈ భారతదేశం. ఆహా, భారతీయులెంతటి భాగ్యశాలురో! ఈ భారతదేశం ఎంత భవ్యమైనదో యోచింపుడు. లోకమంతయు లోకేశుని దేహమైనను దానికి నేత్రముల వంటిది ఈ భారతదేశం. నేత్రహీనమైన దేహం పరాధీనమే కదా. భారతదేశం వేదశాస్త్రాలను నేత్రములతో అలంకరింపబడినది. అందుమూలముననే భారతీయులు పొందినంత సంస్కారమును మరే దేశీయులూ పొందలేరని చెప్పుటలో సందేహమే లేదు. సర్వమత సమత్వమును సహనమును బోధించిన సనాతన ధర్మమే సర్వుల ధర్మము. వివిధ ప్రదేశాలలో పుట్టి వివిధ మార్గాలుగా ప్రవహించి కడకు నదులు సముద్రమును ఎట్లు చేరుచున్నవో అటులనే వివిధ ప్రదేశములలో ఉద్భవించి వివిధ ధర్మమార్గముల ప్రవర్తించి వివిధ ఆరాధనలతో సర్వేశ్వరుని సన్నిధి అను సాగరమును చేరుచున్నారు. నానాదిశలకు ప్రాకునట్టి ఈ భిన్న మార్గములన్నీయూ కలియునట్టి కేంద్రస్థానమే సనాతన ధర్మము. సర్వమతములవారు సత్యవాక్పరులుగా ఉండి ఈర్ష్య కోపరహితులై ప్రేమహృదయులై ప్రవర్తించి సనాతన ధర్మమును అనుష్ఠించవలెను. వీటిని పట్టుబిడక సాధించువాడే భారతీయుడు.
సనాతన ధర్మ ఇస్ ది మదర్ ఆఫ్ ఆల్ రిలీజియన్స్, ఆల్ ట్రెడిషన్స్ అండ్ ఆల్ ధర్మాస్ ఆఫ్ దిస్ వరల్డ్. అండ్ ద బర్త్ ప్లేస్ ఆఫ్ సచ్ అ మదర్ ఇస్ భారత్. హౌ ఫార్చునేట్ ఆర్ ద భారతీయస్. Imagine how glorious is this land of Bharat. If the entire creation is the body of the Lord of the world, then Bharata is this unique body's eyes. Without the eye, is not the body dependent on others? Bharat is adorned with the two beautiful eyes of Vedas and Shastras. Therefore, it can be stated without any ambiguity that the samskaras attained by Bharatiyas cannot be attained by people of other nations. The dharma of all mankind is the Sanatana dharma, which advocates tolerance and unity of all faiths. Rivers may originate from different regions and may flow through different paths, but finally they merge into the ocean. Similarly, people from different lands may follow various faiths and practice many ways of worship, but finally they merge into the ocean of divinity. Sanatana dharma is the confluence of all these multifarious paths. People of all faiths should practice Sanatana dharma by speaking truthfully, refraining from jealousy and anger, and conducting with loving hearts. Therefore, all those who practice this with firm determination and attain it are called Bharatiyas.
So this is a fresh chapter, and Sai Prakash, if you've heard what Bhagwan is saying here, the focus is so much on Sanatana Dharma.
Yeah.
And Bhagwan here, he was talking about samskaras in the previous section, and now Swami is so emphatically mentioning that it can be stated without any ambiguity that the samskaras attained by Bharatiyas cannot be attained by people of other nations. When I read that, I thought, oh my God, is this really true?
Mm.
But then in the end, Swami clarifies, people of all faiths should practice Sanatana Dharma by speaking truthfully, refraining from jealousy and anger, and conducting with loving hearts. Therefore, all those who practice this with firm determination and attain it are Bharatiyas.
Exactly. It's a totally new definition of Bharatiyas.
Yeah.
And so people born in India have reason to celebrate, but they need not take it for granted.
Yeah.
In that sense. But several points that Swami is making in this chapter are very, very interesting, because firstly, you get to realize that Sanatana Dharma is quite different from the Hindu religion that we all think it is. Oftentimes, Hinduism or Hindu religion is referred to Sanatana Dharma, but it's more like Sanatana Dharma is more generic. It's
correct.
It's not just Hinduism as many people think it is.
It is.
And the thing is, I did just a little bit of reading on what Sanatana Dharma is and what Hinduism is. Of although, you know, the words are used interchangeably. You can call Sanatana Dharma as Hinduism and Hinduism as Sanatana Dharma.
But both are very
exactly.
different.
Yeah, very different. So it's more like a way of life. So what they say is Sanatana Dharma, the word Dharma is broader than religion.
Yes.
And in a way, it's more like a way of life. And is a very interesting definition about what Hinduism is. What Hinduism is, which is given by the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Supreme Court of India, it says, unlike other religions in the world, the Hindu religion does not claim any one prophet. It does not worship any one God. It does not believe in any one philosophic concept. It does not follow any one act of religious rites or performances. In fact, it does not satisfy the traditional features of a religion or creed. It is a way of life and nothing more.
Wow. I think well, that's what...
So but I think finally the court got it right, because it says it's just a way of life. And so when Swami is talking about Sanatana Dharma, he says Sanatana Dharma is the mother of all religions and all traditions and all dharmas of this world. And the birthplace of such a mother is Bharat.
Wow. In fact, that's why Swami says, I mean, there is no beginning and there is no end for Sanatana Dharma, actually, Swami says. It's almost like...
the Vedas.
Yeah, it's like the Vedas. And here, Swami is saying the dharma of all mankind is the Sanatana Dharma, which advocates tolerance and unity of all faiths. And I think this is so significant, you know, till now... in Prema Vahini, we have not come across Swami talking about Sanatana Dharma. And the first time he's writing about it, and Swami is saying that this advocates tolerance and unity of all faiths. And in fact, you know, recently I had been to Hampi.
Okay.
You know, Hampi, you have this famous Virupaksha temple.
Absolutely, where Swami gave the darshan.
Yes, I mean, the first... Leela of Bhagwan. I mean, there are so many Leelas, of course, but this was one landmark moment, I think, in Swami's earthly life before he made the declaration of his avatarhood, and which was in a manner of sorts an eye-opener for his brother, Seshma Raju.
True.
And I actually wanted to see, you know, that distance, how far it is. Because, you know, we Swami also narrated, and we have heard the story of how Seshma Raju Garu saw Swami in the shrine. Then he came out and he was looking for Bhagwan, who was standing outside, supposedly looking after the footwear and so all that. And I used to always wonder why of all the temples in India... Swami had to choose, you know, Swami chose this temple. Of course, we never know the answers, but you know, that used to always intrigue me.
Okay.
Because South India, Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, Andhra, they are full of temples.
Absolutely. Maybe I should tell you about my temple tour after you complete.
Okay. And, but of all the places, you know, Swami chose Hampi. And in those days, even now, to travel from Puttaparthi to Hampi, even if you go by car, it's nearly like 5.5-6 hours. And so in those days, it would have been so difficult.
Correct.
For Swami to travel from Morvakonda also to go there, it would have probably in those days would have taken them nearly a day or half a day. So when I was trying to gather information about the historicity of the place and, you know, the significance of that place. Of course, there are a lot of legends. That is the place of the birth of Hanuman. There is a hill called Anjanadri. Anjanadri. And that is where the Kishkindha kingdom was supposed to be there. And Virupaksha gets its name. Of course, Shivaratri is around the corner. It gets the name from Lord Shiva. Apparently, it is at that space, on that spot where Shiva opened his third eye and killed Kama. And because of that Virupa that Shiva took, it was called Virupakshaksha, you know, it refers to the eye. But the interesting thing is, sometime in the 13th century, the Sanatana Dharma was in a manner of sorts in jeopardy because there were a lot of Muslim invasions. And at that point in time, so there were there was a guru called Vidyaranya.
Yes.
And so there were these Hindu kings who wanted to preserve the culture of the land. And so they go to him and they say, you know, we have to do something to maintain our heritage. And so he says, okay, let me pray to the mother. And so he prays to Mother Bhuvaneshwari. And that is how, as a fruit of his penance, he gets blessings from the mother. And then they start building this empire. And we know how it became a very successful empire, which had later on Krishnadevaraya as one of the rulers.
Vijayanagara Empire.
Yeah, the Vijayanagara Empire. And in fact, earlier it was called Vidyanagar, because it was founded by this Vidyaranya. And of course, later on, you have had like four dynasties who have ruled over that place. But generally, one king to whom a lot of credit is attributed to is Sri Krishnadevaraya.
Right.
Of course, before him you also had Harihara and other so many have contributed. And Krishnadevaraya was so particular about preserving this culture that, you know, he built a lot of temples.
Okay.
And one interesting thing was, of course, he was there only for 20 years, but the kind of contribution he has made to the culture of the country is phenomenal. You have temples belonging to all gods.
Okay.
And you also have, in these temples, you also have shrines of Buddha. He even built mosques.
Oh.
And, you know, you find Jain architecture, you find Islamic architecture. You know, so he was someone who, though rooted in Sanatana Dharma, I mean, you might say Hinduism, but you know, he was more rooted in Sanatana Dharma. Sanatana Dharma is taking everyone together.
Right.
So that was the philosophy. So he wanted to ensure that, you know, everyone in the kingdom felt connected.
Correct.
You know, and they participated in this whole process of kingdom building. And so even in the king's quarters, because there were few people who used to serve in the palace, so for them he had built a separate mosque. He built the palace for the queen in Islamic architecture. Because, you know, so that they feel that, you know, the king thinks about us also. And the other thing I found out there was, you know, when, of course, later on, a lot of things happened, and there was again invasion from sultans, and so they destroyed most of the structures. What we have is only ruins now.
Okay.
And of course, which is a very sad thing when you look at those architecture. I mean, you can only imagine what we have lost. But the only temple that is not touched, that was not touched by the Muslims, is the Virupaksha temple, where the shrine is not affected. In all the other temples, the shrines have been, you know, defaced and all that. So they, no worship happens in, be it the Vijay Vithala temple or the Krishna temple or so many other Shiva temples. But only in this Virupaksha temple, worship has been going on non-stop since that time, because the Muslims did not enter this temple. And the Muslims did not enter this temple because the symbol of the Vijayanagara kingdom was a boar, and because Varaha, and a sword which was inverted. And the Muslims apparently for them the boar is just like, you know, there's a superstition among Indians, you know, if a cat crosses your path then you don't cross the path. So they have some kind of superstition, and that's the reason why they didn't actually
okay.
They left that temple.
That's the history.
That yeah. is the history of Europe. But what I was so amazed to see there was, you know, even though you had them you know, destroy all these temples, but wherever there was Islamic architecture, for example the Queen's Palace, you know, wherever there was any semblance of anything Islamic, then all those places have been left untouched. So I felt, okay, at least for one reason, you know, because he had that broad outlook. So today, because that's what he believed in, Sanatan Dharma. Even if you go to the Vijayavita temple, you go to the Rama temple there you have in the designs, in the architecture, inside the temple also you have Buddha, and you have, you know,
very interesting.
That's very interesting, because I felt, you know, they believed in this whole process of taking everyone together. Samasta loka sukhino bhavantu, and that is what Swami is telling, unity of all faiths. That is actually one of the tenets of Sanatan Dharma, and tolerance, to always be accommodative about the other's preferences.
Absolutely. In fact, little bit of, as I said, Googling and Wikipedia, it's very interesting, because I just wanted to know how they define Hinduism. Now, Hinduism and Sanatan Dharma, we use interchangeably the two terms. Although in the back of our minds, we know that, okay, Sanatan Dharma is more generic and more broader in that sense. But what they say is, Sanatan Dharma and Hinduism is so broad in its approach that it accommodates several people of several beliefs. There is no one particular, you know, you can't say this is right and that is not right. So everything is allowed, you know.
Yes. It's,
so he says polytheistic approach is allowed. Monotheistic.
Yes.
Monoistic.
Yes.
Agnostic.
Yes.
Atheistic.
Yes. That also is.
And humanist. Atheistic yes. and humanist.
Yes.
So he says all these forms
yes.
of and beliefs
yes.
are accepted and allowed to thrive
yes.
in Hinduism / Sanatan Dharma, like whatever you call it. So, you know, finally there's another definition, interesting definition by some person called Mac Daniel, in I believe in 2007. So he classifies Hinduism into six major kinds, and he says the first is folk Hinduism, based on local traditions and cults of different deities, and is one of the oldest non-literate system. Then he says Vedic Hinduism, based on the earliest layers of the Vedas traceable to second millennium. Then Vedic Vedantic Hinduism, Vedantic Hinduism based on the philosophy of the Upanishads, including Advaita Vedanta, emphasizing the power of knowledge and wisdom. Yogic Hinduism. Yogic Hinduism is following the text of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, emphasizing introspective awareness. Dharmic Hinduism, or daily morality, which he says is, some people say that this is the only form of Hindu religion which believes in karma. And then the final is Bhakti or devotional Hinduism, where intense emotions are elaborately incorporated in the pursuit of the spiritual. So in this, if you look at it, I mean, it encompasses everything.
And you can add, actually, you can go on adding to the list, actually.
You can keep adding, and it
because
will
if you say Bhakti Hinduism, you can also have Karma Hinduism, you can also have Jnana Hinduism.
Exactly. So Dharmic Hinduism, actually,
you can have Advaita Hinduism, you can have Visishta Advaita Hinduism.
So that's what he says. These are, in a sense, the six major classifications, but everything is, there are numerous minor kinds. So that is how a Western mind looks at it. But the beauty is those words that Swami said, tolerance. He said tolerance and unity. The dharma of all mankind is Sanatana Dharma, which advocates tolerance and unity of all faiths. So he says, this dharma advocates tolerance and unity of all faiths. In a sense, like when you're talking about Hampi, I was also fortunate to visit a few temples in the last 1 week. Like I'd gone for a function, and after that we went around, because the place near Kumbakonam in Tamil Nadu, and Trichy, Tanjavur, and these places have a lot of temples, many temples. So we have been, I would say, binge watching temples. We have been literally bumping from one temple into another. And we started the session today with this whole idea that the sanskaras which have been acquired by Bharatiyas cannot be attained by people of other nations. You know, when I went to these temples and when you think of this, it's so beautifully interconnected in a sense that temples were the centers of life.
Yes.
Temples were the centers of life. And what happened is, even your mundane activities
yes.
were kind of given that spiritual flavor and they were given that spiritual purpose. So people would visit temples on such and such a day and they would do this kind of a pradakshina and they would be chanting the Lord's name. The most harmless things.
Yes.
And you know, and you get good exercise. If you go to Sri Rangam temple, for example, 1.5 kilometers you have to walk from one gopuram to the other. That itself is immense.
Yes.
And so you're in the best of health.
Yes.
And so what happens is, your samskaras, like Swami has been talking about samskaras in the past chapter, these are actions that you do regularly, and these are things that stay in your mind. See, as Swami defined it in the previous chapter, samskara is what stays in your mind at the end of your life. Now, if you look at it, when you start doing something regularly, there is more likely that those ideas and those approaches stay in your mind. So they stay in your mind and they become your samskaras. So now, if it has been our tradition that you have to go to the temple on such and such a date, and what is more interesting is you have to go to such and such a deity on such and such a date, you have to go to the other deity on such and such a date. And another very interesting aspect which I found very interesting is, suppose for example, you go to a Ganesha temple. Now you are kind of told and illustrated that every other god that exists worships Ganesha. Okay. Then you go to Shiva's temple. Now Vishnu is made to look like a person who has always worshipped Shiva. But you go to Vishnu temple.
Yes.
And you say, oh God, Shiva eternally is worshipping Vishnu.
Yes.
Now, just in Hinduism itself,
yes.
in Sanatana Dharma, you have so many
yes.
forms of the Lord. But in some sense, I feel it is also very deliberate, these stories,
yes.
these Puranas,
yes.
this, so that, you know, there is no difference. You
yes.
don't really separate them out.
Correct.
And so it all, you know, kind of becomes a way of life. So that way of life itself is samskara.
In fact, you know, as you are mentioning about this, as I was going through this, one of the temples, there is Vijaya Vithala temple. And, you know, I overheard some Westerners speaking. And, you know, so they were wondering, what is this Hinduism all about? They're totally confused.
They should listen to this episode of...
Because, you know, one of them saying, oh, this is so confusing. You know, Hinduism, it's completely, you can't make anything out of it. You know, so other people, that's why I think Buddhism is simpler.
No, I had an interesting, same thing, when there were some foreigners
yes.
in one of the temples, and there was a violent Indian who was like telling them, don't tell such things, because there is a meaning to everything. Obviously, that person himself didn't know the meaning, so he had to shout it out. So if you tell them what the meaning is, they yes. will obviously understand.
Yes.
So I think
on the face of it, it looks so complex. Yeah.
Now, that is the beautiful part of
yes.
our culture and Sanatana Dharma, because why Swami is saying this statement, which is very beautiful. He says, the samskaras that we attain by Bharatiyas, nobody else can attain it, because everything that is represented and shown in an external form, in the form of sculptures, in the form of art, in the form of rituals, in the form of practices, all points to a deeper inner spiritual truth.
Yes.
There is absolute coherence between what you see outside and what the actual truth is. Like a temple is, for example, done in such and such a way. And you have to cross 7 steps before you go there. You have to go cross the 7 gates.
Yes.
And everything is very symbolic.
Yes.
And for people who do not get the symbolism, they are anyway benefited. But for those who get the symbolism, they are inspired.
Yes.
Now, this was a very interesting conversation I had with one of the elderly priests in the Chidambaram temple. So when we went to the Chidambaram temple, there are many unique things about the Chidambaram temple.
Yes.
And in fact, he was like mentioning that it is more than 2 lakh years and it cannot be dated and all that. And of course, the lot of mystical stories like Narada came, this came, yes. ABCD, everybody came. That's fine. But the Chidambara Rahasyam is one aspect which everybody is very fascinated about. And that is actually got to do with the golden dome on top of the Sanctum Sanctorum. So it's like a sloping dome on top, a huge dome, and it has got 21,600 gold leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 21,600 is symbolic because that is the number of breaths we take in a single day.
Day, correct.
And how did people actually measure? And he said 21,600 gold leaves, it was already there. And then somewhere in the 2nd century, they repolished the gold and they applied new leaves by some Chola king or something. So, and that has remained like that ever since. Now, what he explained about the temple was very interesting. In the sense, he said, the whole approach to worship. He said, now, for example, in this temple, you find this beautiful form of the Lord Shiva in the dance pose. Nataraja is the dance pose, and Chidambaram temple has the beautiful statue of Lord Shiva in the dance pose. And he says, but you have so many temples where there is only the Shivalinga. And so he said, this is for different people, different levels of evolution in the spiritual realm. Like, initially you need a form.
Yes.
You need to love the form. You need to adore the form. But the form is something you can see, and you can speak about, you can describe, you have, you know, attributes, you have, you know, descriptions.
Easily understandable.
Understandable, relatable, and relatable. Yeah. So that is the initial stage. Then you go to the level of a lingam, Shivalingam.
Yes.
Now, what can you describe about the Shivalingam?
Just a symbol now.
It's a symbol. Mm. So you become subtler. You go subtler where you see the lingam, and it's you're trying to internalize the rest of it.
Yeah.
Now, when you see the lingam, what do you feel? You feel that, okay, here is a power that does not have a beginning or an end. So here is, so it's symbolic of what actually you want to convey. While the form of the Lord, like Lord Shiva's form, you see, you find the snake, which are also symbolic of, you know, the elements. You have the third eye, the water,
the moon.
Everything. Yeah. So these are also symbolic in a sense, but then they are all attributed to the form of the Lord. Then you go to the Shivalinga, which is just a symbol. And it's a pointer to the truth which is inside you. So he says the ultimate level is when you close your eyes and realize that you are that power. You are that spiritual power which is being worshipped. That spiritual power is in you and you are one with it. So there are several levels of...
So in Chidambara Rahasya they say, I mean, it is actually Akashalingam. It is just ether, right?
Yeah, it is known to be an Akashalingam, but there is a very small Spatika Lingam. A crystal lingam.
Otherwise, what I had read is very difficult when you say Chidambara Rahasya, it is actually nothing. I mean, that nothing is everything. But as you are mentioning, you move on from that Sakara, you know, to the subtle, and then to the subtlest level.
To the subtlest level. Yeah. And so what happens is, one or two very interesting things which is always like, I saw a person actually reading some scriptures and a few people sitting and listening to him. Not many, of course, and none, no youngsters there. But there was still interest. And so this person was actually reading out a particular work, and he was explaining to them the inner meaning, the significance of what the scriptures say. And so obviously in the olden times, it would be a very interesting thing to know why such and such a thing was made like this. why this temple architecture was made like this. Even today, it's so interesting.
Yeah.
So yes. You can imagine today.
It's so scientific, actually.
Yeah, scientific and pointers. These are all pointers to the inner reality.
Yes.
Today, when we have access to so much entertainment and we have so much, exposure to so many things on the net, on television, etc. When you visit a temple, you're still intrigued by it.
Yes.
You're still intrigued by the nuances of why they did.
We have not demystified even perhaps, 10% of what that temple is.
Exactly. Yeah. Why would they do this?
Yeah.
Then imagine life in those centuries where there had no other form of entertainment.
Yes.
So obviously they came to the temple to see a dance performance.
Mm.
That's why you have 1,000-pillared dance halls, mandapams.
Yes.
Then they came there to see the artwork.
Yes.
And they came to see the scientific wonders of temples.
Yes.
Like the shadow will never touch the ground.
Yes.
And you have rock chains.
Yes.
Without any cut.
Yes.
Then you have amazing sculptures.
You have
with
musical pillars.
Musical pillars.
Yes. Yeah.
Then you have single rock sculptures.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And then you have sculptures where you feel that the flesh is actually cut. I mean, that's kind of marvelous sculptures.
Yes.
And then informative sculptures.
Yes.
So all these things, you come to the temple again.
Yes.
Then you have the scientific advancements.
Yes.
Like even to build a temple, okay, this is these many meters high.
Mm-hmm.
How did they actually take it up there? The architectural marvels, like you go to the Brihadishwara temple in Tanjore, they say that they had to fill sand on a gradient for about 5 to 6 kilometers.
Oh my God.
Because
5 to 6 kilometers.
Kilometers. Because the topmost, the topmost part of the sanctum sanctorum, which is like a gopuram, on top of it, there is a single rock sculpture weighing 80 tons.
Oh my God.
80 tons.
Tons.
Now, how do you transport an 80-ton piece of single rock on top of something like 216 meters high? So, they had to build this gradient of sand and elephants walk and carry the rock slowly, and then it had to go and fix in there.
Wow.
So, these are all marvels.
Absolutely.
These are all engineering feats. But the beauty is, they were also connected to the Lord.
Yes, absolutely. And that is what is so beautiful. I mean, the two imagery come to my mind as you're mentioning how the temple was the center of everything.
Exactly.
The center of the people's lives, whatever they did, whether it was art, even if they want to just relax. I mean, the temples had so much space also in those times.
Absolutely.
So if you want in the evening, you just want to go and relax, that was the recreation center, that was the center for all productive activities, that was the center. If you want to buy things also in front of the temple, there should be the huge market. So, if there's any family function, so be it anything to do with your personal life, social life, professional life.
Right.
I think the temple was the heart of everything.
Absolutely.
So that's how people always connected with God. In fact, Krishnadevaraya also was such a fantastic king. Later on, once the Sultan sort of conquered Hampi, most of the people moved to Penukonda. And in Penukonda, you have actually, I just realized, a little replica of Hampi, because you have, in Penukonda, you have 365 temples actually. There are more temples than houses in Penukonda.
Oh, really?
Which is just 1 hour from here.
365 temples?
Temples, yes.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Because the idea of Krishnadevaraya was that every day of the year, people should think about God. So he built 365 temples, and so these are temples dedicated to all gods.
Fantastic.
Including, Jains and, Buddhist shrines and Jain shrines and everything.
Mm.
So, now, what I was trying to say is, so, you, just like you had temples as the center of everything, everything merged into a temple, So, similarly here, Swami is telling, all the dharmas, everything merges into ultimately Sanatana Dharma. And Sanatana Dharma is what, ultimately, it merges into the ocean of divinity. So, everything, so whatever is a system of philosophy, I think that's why Swami is telling so emphatically that, everything, whichever religions you may follow, whichever path you may take, finally, it is all a branch of Sanatana Dharma only. Because the philosophy is so grand and so accommodative, and there is no thought process connected to man, nature and God, which is not there in Sanatana Dharma.
Absolutely. In fact, a very interesting point which comes up is, he says, there is immense diversity.
Mm.
At the same time, there is immense unity.
Yes.
When it comes to people who are followers of Sanatan yes. Dharma and yes. Slash Hinduism. Now, I'm yes. not really differentiating between the two. So, he says, if you look at the diversity aspect of it, they follow all, like we said, mono, different gods, yes. single gods, then atheistic approach, agnostic approach. So many approaches are there. But a sense of unity is that invariably everybody respects the Vedas. So that is something which is very unique. They say, although the Sanatan Dharma or Hinduism does not have one prescribed text,
yes.
like you don't have a single Bible or a Quran as the holy text, there are several holy texts.
Yes.
Now, it's interesting because you have the Shrutis and the Smritis. So if you look at it, Shrutis and Smritis, Shrutis are something which is heard. Like the Vedas. The Vedas are heard and passed on from yes. generation to generation. And the Smritis are that which is remembered.
Yes.
And which is a tradition. It is not a revelation, but it's a tradition. So you have Puranas, Itihasas, and all these are all Smritis. They are not heard, they are written down. They are born from man's imagination. So, Shruti and Smriti. So here in one of the lines, Swami says, just as the two beautiful eyes, just as a person is dependent on others if he or she loses their eyes, so also Bharat
yes.
is the central, is so beautiful because it has the two eyes of Vedas and Shastras. So Bharat is adorned with the two beautiful eyes of Vedas and Shastras. And he says, the eyes are so important. So just as without an eye, the body is dependent on others, the entire creation is the body of the Lord. And Bharata is the unique body's eyes. It's a very beautiful comparison.
So you, as you say, Mark Darshak, I mean, the Swami should always say that India will always be the lighthouse of the world.
Yeah, because, see, India is the eyes of the world, and the Vedas and Shastras are the eyes of India. So they yes. are like, they give.
And Vedas are aporishayas. They have come from the divine.
Exactly.
Yes.
So he says that that gives it its sense of indefinite and, everlasting.
Absolutely tradition. Unique nature. In fact, you know, as you are mentioning about this, uniqueness
right.
of Indian culture and India. I remember reading some time back some comments made by Don Taylor. He was a British journalist
okay.
Who came to India during the British time. And later on, he was someone who sympathized with Indians. And he was a sympathetic visitor. So in 1969, you know, he wrote something about India. By that time, you know, India had got independence and, you know, he was amazed that India was still united. Because, you know, a lot of people who came to India at that point in time, especially from the West after British started ruling India, they thought it always intrigued them about this land. Because they used to say that, you know, the writing is on the wall. This whole land is going to disintegrate at any point in time. That is what everyone thought. And, you know, as someone said, India has a well-established reputation for violating social scientific generalizations. I mean, you want to follow the social patterns, the way it happens in any country, how in Europe, you know, different people who speak one language come together and in the breakaway, you see the patterns everywhere, and India breaks
all those patterns.
Breaks all those whatever set patterns in social system. So he says, the key question remains, can India remain in one piece or will it fragment? When one looks at this vast country and its 524 million people, you know, he's talking about 1969, now it's almost double, the 15 major languages in use, the conflicting religions, the many races, it seems incredible that one nation could ever emerge. It is difficult to even encompass this country in the mind. The great Himalayas, the wide Indo-Gangetic plain burnt by the sun and savaged by the fierce monsoon rains, the green flooded delta of the east, the great cities like Kolkata, Mumbai, and Madras, it does not often seem like one country. And he says, and yet there is a resilience about India which seems an assurance of survival, there is something which can only be described as an Indian spirit.
Beautiful, beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And that's it. And that's why I think even that famous series, The Spirit of India, was a series of documentaries made on India, I think by BBC, if I'm not mistaken. Very beautifully made, where they go back to the history of India and they go back to what that spirit of India is. What is that spirit of India? It's so amazing where, you know, like Swami used to say, Khanda Khandantara Khyatinathinchina, that poem is so beautiful. And he say, every grain of sand is infused with goodness.
Goodness.
Manchitanamu.
Yes.
The goodness is so integral to this, the whole nature of who an Indian is or a Bharatiya is. And
wow. In fact, you know, that reminds me of that story of Alexander, when Alexander came to India.
Right.
And, you know, he was exploring this land and... So he goes to this little town and he sees that, you know, so at that point in time, whatever is the court, the local court there, so there is a dispute there, and he sees there are two parties. So there is a buyer and a seller.
Okay.
And so this person who has bought a piece of land from the seller, he goes to the court and says that, I bought this piece of land for this much money, but when I, after that, dug the land, you know, to sow the crops, I found that inside there was a pot of gold. And he says, I have not bought the pot of gold. I have paid him only for the land. So the pot of gold does not belong to me.
My goodness.
And so he goes to the seller and says, you know, please take it. And seller says, come on, you can't do this to me. I have not sold the pot of gold to you. I sold only the land to you. And I had no clue that there is a pot of gold in the land. And I have no rights about, on that gold. Why are you giving it to me? You know? I mean, when Alexander saw that, he said, oh my God, am I on earth or am I, you know, in heaven?
It's amazing. Because, you know, it all comes back to those three tenets which Swami says. Love for God, fear of sin, and morality in society. And more and more, like again, when you go to these temples, and what are they depicting in these temples? They show the conquest of good over evil.
Yes.
They show Mahishasura is being killed by the Devi. And they show that, you know, when somebody had ego, Lord Shiva went, it's like, he crushed the ego.
Yes.
He crushed the elephant. Yes. So many stories.
Tripura Asura.
There's so many stories. The Puranas are all full of stories which explain these concepts to, you know,
and that is
common
how,
folk.
I mean, that is how all these Puranas, you know, if you see, the temple had everything about the culture. I mean, I saw, for example, in this Vijaya Vithala temple, and the Rama, there's the Rama temple, Hazara Rama temple. You have the entire sort of Ramayana, scenes from Ramayana sculpted in stone. The entire, in that entire, and what creativity in those sculptures. I mean.
Absolutely. The sculptures, the stories, the depictions, and, though that was the internet of that age.
Yeah.
Like, for example, that
their internet was so strong, really.
That was Google. You go to Madurai Meenakshi temple, and if you are able to understand the sculptures of all the pillars there, that is a Google of, you know, Sanatana Dharma.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, because there's so many stories. And the Gopurams.
Gopurams, oh yeah.
Oh, the Gopurams are full of stories. The Gopurams are full of depictions. So, I, in a sense, when Swami says about sanskaras and people, Bharatiyas, it's very important because you are steeped in a particular understanding. And that understanding has got everything to do with the actual truth. And somewhere or the other, you are leading, you are being led from one level to the other. But unfortunately, again, like in all places, only a few go from one place to another. Many are locked up in the rituals. Many are locked up in the traditions. Oh, you should not do this. You should not do that. You should not do this. all that is fine. I mean, that is fine to a certain level. But then what is the spirit with which it's actually being told? So, it's very interesting. The huge Srirangam temple, for example, is so massive, and you go to several levels of Gopurams, and then you finally reach the sanctum, and Lord Ranganatha is in a beautiful pose, is reclining, and there is this Adishesha, and it's like a circular sanctum, very beautiful shrine. But when you see that, and you see the Lord, and you have his darshan, invariably you start thinking, what is the meaning? Like, you know, people who... initially, people are just seeing the Lord and they're happy and they... Then, you know, if you start... even if you start going to the temple again and again every day...
It'll keep speaking to you.
it keeps taking you to one level deeper, one level deeper. Why is he lying down? Why? What is he actually doing? Is he always in this pose? Then, otherwise, what is it? Is he trying to awaken something from within us? You know, you start thinking several meanings, and... The beauty is these stories and these Puranas have created all these forms of the Lord to inspire you into that.
Wow. I think, you know, when Bhagwan is saying that people of all faiths should practice Sanatana Dharma by speaking truthfully, refraining from jealousy and anger, and conducting with loving hearts. And all those who practice this with firm determination and attain it. So, you know, so just because you are born in India, you don't become a Bharatiya.
Absolutely.
And Swami is telling, you have to practice this and attain it. Only then you become a Bharatiya. I mean, to speak truthfully, to refrain from jealousy and anger, to conduct with loving hearts. I mean, I remember on one occasion while speaking to students in Trai Vrindavan, Swami told the boys, you don't know how fortunate you are. This happened in the 90s. You know, how Bhagwan used to speak to students informally after bhajan sessions. And one day Swami decided to give a discourse. And Swami said, do you know why you are so fortunate? For three reasons. One, Swami said, you are born as a human being. Don't ever underestimate that.
Correct.
Because only a human being can think about... just eating, sleeping and multiplying. Only a human being can think about something higher and going back to the source. And then Swami says, the second most thing you should be really, really grateful is that you are born in India.
In India, that's true. Maybe to rephrase it correctly, you are a Bharatiya.
Bharatiya.
Being born in India doesn't categorize you to... So, in the same...
But Swami says... See, the thing is, you have greater chances of becoming a Bharatiya if you are born in India.
In India. Yeah. So somebody is born elsewhere in any part of the world, they can also become Bharatiyas.
I mean, you look at the ashram today, you have so many Russians.
Yeah, they are also Bharatiyas.
Bharatiyas, And then, of course, the third thing Swami mentioned, which was obvious, Swami told me, you are having the chance to live with the avatar, which is once in a... in a millennia, you get the opportunity. So I think, and I remember when I was a student, you know, when Bhagwan used to talk about India and Indian culture, Swami used to so emphatically mention about Indian culture.
Right.
You know, I used to sometimes wonder, Swami, please don't speak so highly about Indian culture because there are people of other lands here. You know, somebody might get offended, you know, in my foolishness as a schoolboy. You know, Swami, there are Russians, there are Germans. Talk about their culture also, let them also feel happy. But Swami was very clear. Indian culture is what is necessary for the world. This is the only thing that will save the world.
Right.
In fact, even this Don Taylor, you know, in the end he says, I believe it no exaggeration to say that the fate of Asia hangs on India's survival. In fact, he was to some extent right. Swami says the fate of the whole world hangs on India's survival.
And like he says, that's the engine. And the rest of the countries are like the bogies.
Yes.
So that's why he called all his summer courses as summer course in Indian culture and spirituality.
Yes.
So I think Sanatana Dharma, Indian culture is very, very deep because it connects us back to what the truth is.
Yes.
And it connects us back to it empowers us to believe that we are one with the divine power.
Yes. And Bharat, Swami says, is the land where everyone has rati. Right?
Mm. Love for the Lord.
Love for God. Love for God. I mean, you have the power of knowledge.
Right. Bharati. Mm. Bhagwan Rati.
Bhagwan Rati.
So you have love for the
love
Lord.
Love for God. I mean, and of course, I personally feel that we are currently living in very interesting times. You see a resurgence among the younger generation today, especially in India. They're valuing their culture, actually. You know, they're being proud, which was not there perhaps, you know, 50, 60 years ago, because at that time you were so much enamored by the West's sort of development. And now people are realizing the profundity of their roots. So now you have, you know, the people even in their 15s, in their 16, you know, people in their 20s, you have the students who take a lot of pride in being an Indian. They may not follow all the tenets of Indian culture, but at least they know that, you know, their culture is something very profound, and they are seeking answers. They are seeking answers for everything that, you know, that has come down to us from our forefathers. And I think it is for all of us now to go deep, try to understand all that has been passed on to us, and try to communicate to whatever extent we can to the succeeding generation, so that they take to it more gladly and more enthusiastically. So, dear listeners, well, this topic of Indian culture is very interesting, and there are many aspects about Indian culture which we will be discussing in the future episodes of Vahini Satsang. In this chapter, which where Bhagwan has already started the discussion on Indian culture, there are many beautiful subsequent segments in this chapter 17. Please stay tuned. And if you have any interesting things to share about India, about your insights, about Bharat, Bharati, being a Bharatiya, and Bharat, please feel free to share with us. As always, you can write to listener@radiosai.org. Offering our gratitude to Bhagwan for enabling us to have this session and be in this satsang where we discuss about this glorious land, Bharatiya, Bharat. We offer this program at his lotus feet. Thank you so much for being with us. Sayonara.